the Transverse Network, this is The Transgender Show, an interview program about self-acceptance and discovery. I'm your host, Emily. This week on the show are Avi Sekatapulu and Anne Pellegrini, psychoanalysts and authors investigating the factors that contribute to gender and identity. In their work, they have found the notion of core gender identity, or the born this way argument, too simplistic or even problematic. All genders and sexualities, they argue, whether queer, straight, trans, non-binary, or cis, are the result of complex psychic and social processes. Their controversial take is that no one's gender or sexuality is innate. Pellegrini and Sekatapulu assert that developmental events, even traumas, play an important role in all of this. But to say that trauma may sometimes have a share in becoming trans or becoming queer does not mean trans or queer people are broken. Rather, they argue that trauma can function as an engine for transformation and growth. Anne and Avi, welcome to the Transgender Show.
Thank you for having us, Emily.
It's really a pleasure to get to speak with you. Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this. And I thought I had misrepresented it earlier when I talked about this show on our new show. And I said that your basic premise is that gender identity, whether cis or trans, originates in trauma. And I told that to you in the pre-interview, and you said that's basically it. Was there anything else in that intro, that, you know, 10,000 foot view that I just delivered, that is missed, or you know, are there any subtleties there that you'd like to expand on right now?
I mean, you know, it's first of all, like, what a great way to start, to start with a question of like where misunderstandings lie, and where in our effort to not have a misunderstanding, we actually get something right. So you kind of like said to us right before we were starting, like, I think I got this wrong. And for some people, like, thinking about the connection between trauma and gender, especially non-normative gender, is very, very frightening, because we usually have just one kind of association between the two, the notion that trauma breaks you. And if you have a non-normative gender identity, that's because you have somehow been warped out of your gender, which should have been cis as assigned at birth. And what we want to do is actually push back against the resistance that even those of us who live in queer communities and who have been having conversations like this with each other, for those of us who are clinicians with our patients, know that some of this stuff is happening, and that this is partly how gender can work for some people, not for everyone, but for some people. Mm-hmm. But we're afraid to talk about it out loud. So part of our work has been to kind of like make the space to think more complexly, but also to reassure communities with which we are allied, communities, queer people and trans people, that it's okay to think complexly. And it's okay to think about the resource of complexity that is routinely afforded to cis and straight people, but which subjects that have been minoritized are usually not allowed to have.
Yeah, I'm thinking that, you know, at numerous times in writing the book, we kept checking in with each other, like, can we really say this? Because we're really worried that making public this argument that, again, many of us are having behind closed doors, not just in our, you know, consulting rooms with between, you know, therapists and patients, but many queer and trans people have been having these conversations with each other. Can we really say out loud and publish in a book the idea that trauma, rather than warping who we are, can actually help provide an energy or an engine for making who we are? And that's actually a good thing. Like, in some sense, what people do with trauma is something that can be enlivening. I can actually be a source of flourishing. But this is a scary argument to make when any connection between trauma and queerness or trauma and transness is usually used to disqualify it, to say, oh, well, if there's a relationship between trauma and the fact that you're a dyke, then let's fix you. Or if there's a relationship between trauma and the fact that you're trans, again, let's fix you. That warped who you were. And we're just, again, we're arguing against that, but we've been concerned about weaponization of our argument because we are deeply invested in queer and trans flourishing. Mm. But we, you know, we decided that it was worth and actually even necessary to dare saying this aloud, because the born this way argument, which we actually find, well, I would say personally, doesn't work for me. I actually find there, I think there are all sorts of ethical shortcomings in it, but the Born This Way argument hasn't been working politically. It's not protecting trans people. It's not protecting queer people. So why not make a more complex argument?
That's fascinating. And we obviously have so much to dive into in all of that. But first off, I wanted to kind of step way back and let everyone in our audience know, what is your connection to the trans or and LGBT communities? And how long have you been working in this field?
And I'm happy to jump in first. So I am queer identified. I identify also as genderqueer. And I have actually been teaching queer theory. In addition to being a psychoanalyst, I'm a professor at NYU, and I've been teaching queer theory, something that also travels under the name LGBTQ studies, actually since I received my PhD, so basically for 30 years. And I'm deeply invested in, you know, I feel really lucky that I get to spend so much of my time introducing young people to ideas about, say, this, you know, sort of about gender and sexuality and historical perspective and the politics of gender and sexuality. And it's not that I'm just, it's not simply that I'm introducing young people, you know, the kids today, to these ideas. They're educating me because, you know, generational challenges, changes have happened. And I learn so much from my students as well, especially as the age difference just increases. The students stay the same age, but I keep getting older. So I am constantly being educated by contact with my student, including being educated in how they're thinking about gender and sexuality and the, you know, what these categories mean to them. And in some sense, this, but feels like for all the ways in which young people, I think, are too often characterized as somehow being rigid and, oh, they just, you know, they don't allow for disagreement. In fact, I find, you know, they're actually really game for trying out new arguments and actually very capacious. So I, you know, I just find that delightful. So I, you know, I've been very lucky. In fact, to be kind of a, I sometimes joke, I'm like, I'm paid to be a homosexual. It's pretty awesome. And I work with a lot of queer and trans people in my psychoanalytic practice as well, which is actually a real joy and very humbling to get to sit with people and hear about their experiences week after week.
And Avi, what is your connection to the community and your history?
So I am... I'm queer identified myself. I grew up very immersed in queer and trans communities. I grew up in Greece and Cyprus and moved here as an adult, here being in the States, and I live and practice in New York. And when I first came to the States, I trained as a clinical psychologist. And when I was doing my PhD, when we were doing our practicums, I asked whether I could be placed in a clinic to work with trans people. And that was long before this was in the conversation the way it is now. And the response that I received was I was called into a private meeting with some of the faculty to discuss why my focus is so narrow and was I open to learning. So that was my really first big slap in the experience of like what it means to learn how to work with trans people clinically. So after that, I trained as a psychoanalyst. I've been working with trans people. I also work with kids, and a big chunk of my child practice is with kids who are exploring their gender, who identify as trans or non-binary. And I've been doing that work for 20 years with kids and their families.
I thought this would be a really good topic for the show because I feel like one of the things that trans people struggle with the most is the question of why am I this way? And I feel like there's a lot of pitfalls in that, or there's a feeling there might be pitfalls in that when you're kind of diving into it and you might uncover something that proves that you're wrong or that you know, there's something wrong with you. What results have you seen in doing this sort of deep dive with clients, and how has it affected their belief in their identities?
That's such a great question. Actually, and I'm thinking you should respond first. I mean, given that you've also been working with young people, because I work with adults from, you know, sort of 18 and up, but you've also been working with kids.
Yeah, sure. I was actually, when you said, Emily, that kind of like that a lot of trans people are asking themselves, why am I this way? I was thinking it's so interesting to be speaking to somebody who's trans identified, because when we speak about kind of like the book that we wrote about these ideas called Gender Without Identity, when we speak about our book to people who don't identify as trans or non-binary, the question we get is, but is it okay to ask this question? Like, it's only clinicians or transphobes who ask the question of why am I this way? And that is just not true. trans people ask this question of themselves all the time. And it's usually asked in kind of like in the tenor that you were also implying earlier, which has the echo of, is there something wrong with me? Could I have done something different so that I wouldn't have to be kind of like suffering all the things that come with being trans, which is not to say that only misery comes with transness. Like a lot of pleasures also come with being trans, and a lot of experiences of joy and experiences of kind of like poignant experiences that one might have not had. But we are very interested in this question, and we want to wrest it away from the frameworks in which it is usually given to us, which is the notion that it can only be asked problematically. So in my practice, I have patients, until they trust me, stay away from this question. But once they start trusting the clinician, they can ask that question of themselves. And then really, if you can stay with that as a therapist without too much anxiety, without fearing that that you have to now prove that you have like good, kind of like good political cred, but you actually stay close with a patient, you find that all kinds of interesting things come up around what stories people tell about themselves, about how they became trans. And I want to emphasize the word became here, because part of our argument in the book is that nobody is born into their gender, cis people either, that everybody becomes a gender. Traumatic experience is also one that often worries trans people in terms of like some trans people in terms of their experience. Like is the question of, for example, if I had sexual trauma and that my gender has kind of like become inflected in a different way after that experience, does that mean that the gender that I experience now is not valid? Does it mean that it's just a symptom of trauma? Does it mean that, or did it have nothing to do with the violation? And usually we say it had nothing to do with it. It was always there. We look for certain kinds of stories, like for somebody to be eligible for valid transness, they have to have experienced some things from very early on, to have a certain kind of gender dysphoria, body dysphoria, like all terms that are tied to very old ways of thinking about transness. But a lot of space opens up in the clinic and in other conversations when we can go down the path of allowing people to become curious about what has contributed to their gender. There's no reason to be afraid of that in a safe space, in a relatively speaking safe space, even though, of course, there's all the reasons to be afraid of that because of how it's used politically.
Mm-hmm. And maybe if I could just underscore something which has to do with curiosity. This is about actually helping to provide a space that cultivates curiosity. It's not our task. In fact, it would be irresponsible mm-hmm. for us to be saying to anyone we're sitting with, what do you think made you trans? What do you think made you queer? We might be wondering that, but that's not our question. It needs to be something that arises as a question for the person we're sitting with, that a curiosity they develop about their self. And so we're following the person we're sitting with. We're not out in front leading the way. You know, this is, you know, the time you meet with someone, that's their time, not ours. And it's, again, it's really a privilege to get to do this kind of work. And it's, you know, it's allowing for something to develop that has to belong to the person, to the patient, not to the therapist. Right. Again, it's not our session, it's theirs. And so I think it's really important to stress that we're not trying to sort of get people to tell their stories in this way. We want to hear what stories they're telling, what questions they're asking, and maybe provide space for new kinds of questions to arise that are the questions of the person asking them, again, not ours. And it's just such an important question. And I know we were just talking about it in the clinic, but I've also had the experience and experiences with that question in the classroom. And you know, one particular experience really stands out for me. It was actually with a student who was at the time identifying as lesbian, and we actually write about it in the book. But basically, you know, I teach classes which draw on historical materials that demonstrate that gender, like heterosexuality and homosexuality, are fairly recent inventions. It's a fairly novel development in human history that people identify themselves around whom they maybe more regularly have sex with, the kinds of the so-called gender of the people they have sex with. This is a fairly recent historical development and very culturally specific. So I teach these historical materials. And so I had the student, hands shot up. I'd been teaching a unit probably with Michel Foucault, and the student said, I get it. You know, sexuality, it's socially constructed, but what made me a lesbian? And, the hand, I feel like, the hand came down, but the fist was still up there. It was such, I love this question. It was challenging, it was provocative, and I can't stop thinking about it. And, I gave some sort of answer that, oh, actually, this is so great because yes, we've got these persuasive historical accounts, but they're macro level. None of these accounts can actually say why this category, which recently became available, historically speaking, spoke to you. I mean, this is where psychoanalysis has a lot to say. It's a space in which people can actually think about and talk about how the category spoke to them. And this is actually what queer and trans gossip is for as well. Like when we're in our communities and we're doing gossip exchanges with each other, including trading our coming out stories, we're basically doing our own versions of, what do you think made you queer? What do you think made you trans, right? We are doing that all the time because, again, we can read our, social constructionist histories. We can read our Judith Butler, Michel Foucault, Jeffrey Weeks, whatever, but we want to know about us. It's really fun and pleasurable to actually ask those questions. And these might not be the questions that are yet ready for our political manifestos, but I kind of think, well, why not? Like, can we take these much more complex and even pleasurable and curious stories we're telling about ourselves and churn them into something that could transform the kinds of political conversations we have about gender?
Well, and that's such a fascinating topic to bring up too, that I often forget about, just how recent cisgender and homosexual identities are, how new they are relatively. And what that means is that historically you just had sex with who you wanted to have sex with, and it wasn't a thing, it was okay. Essentially, what we're kind of doing is we're funneling ourselves. We're sort of putting ourselves in silos and separating ourselves more on these identities. And I feel like that's how we get into the gatekeeping and problems that we see in the communities a lot of time, because if you fit into a column, if you fit into a group, you have to then behave in a certain way. It sort of locks you in. It creates this feeling that we need to stay in our own little lanes and can't vary so much.
One of the critiques that we hear very often in politics, but also in our field, is that to think, to be trans or to talk about transness is to become overly preoccupied with identity and therefore to be too flat in one's thinking about identity. And what this misses is that we live in a world where identity claims is what makes some things possible politically and in terms of rights, like in terms of being able to get health coverage in some way, in terms of being able to argue for certain kinds of political or legal coverage. But psychic experience, and this is where psychoanalytic thinking has been very helpful to us, psychic experience actually doesn't fit in these neat boxes. And being trans can mean a million different things. There's no such thing as a prototypical trans person. There's no such thing as a right trans person. And the commitment that we have in our book, in our lives, but also in writing this book, is that there's nothing wrong with being queer or trans or non-binary. There's no wrong way to be queer or trans or non-binary. And there's no wrong way to become queer or trans or non-binary. We want to refuse the blackmail that there is a proper path to transness, like somebody who has experienced things in a very particular way, uses certain words for themselves, kind of like has always been this or that, and only that counts, and any other experience is invalidated.
I think there's a way in which in this book we kind of want to have it both ways. For example, we want to say it doesn't matter how anyone became queer or trans, because there's nothing wrong with being queer or trans, right? So we want to say that. And yet we also know that it does indeed matter to those of us who are queer or trans. We often are curious. We want to be able to talk about this without being shamed. And partly we sometimes want to talk about this so as in some sense, even to loosen the shame we may feel about having become queer or haven't become trans, or maybe we think we're not queer enough or trans enough, right? So we, again, this, we want it both ways. It doesn't matter, and yet it does. Mm-hmm. Similarly, with respect to identity, we think that identity can indeed, as you just suggested, Emily, sometimes be too constricting, too rigid, but it's also politically necessary currently. And it can also be a site for flourishing and even sexiness. People eroticize their identities. And people, sometimes the erotics of our identity, I'm thinking, you know, with respect to both sex and gender, that some of the erotics of our identity are sometimes when we act out in ways that don't even fit with our identity. That's something going, sometimes going rogue in respect to how we think we should be or actually even feel ourselves to be, kind of has heat to it, right? So I also want to think about identity as something that might even be a site of pleasure. If we can maybe, I mean, maybe if we can sort of play with it a little bit.
Yeah, and then that brings up another pitfall, right? Of like the, for trans women, one of the big things for invalidation from the outside is autogynephilia. You just are obsessed.
I was just thinking that.
And, you know, sexually turned on by the idea of having a vagina. And
I was just thinking about that. It's so interesting you say this. It's really great. I was just thinking of how there is this, kind of like this, it's an old theory, but it's a trope that circulates a lot that that ties the excitement that comes with being in one's gender, is how I would describe it, and pathologizes it by turning it into a fetish. Mm. So the old story used to be that trans women are autogynephiliacs, meaning that they get turned on by presenting themselves to themselves as women. So built into the notion of autogynephilia is the premise that there's something inauthentic about gender. It's not gender, it's really a fetish, right? It's a really kind of like a kind of like an obsession, a sexual obsession, which of course misses the fact that that cis women kind of like get turned on by their gender all the time. Like otherwise, I mean, there's so much that cis women do with their gender, with what it means. I mean, we call this feeling sexy, mm-hmm. right? To feel sexy is part of what can be arousing, and it is very gender related. And it follows a sort of practices that have to do with culture that you may select from an array of what's available in the cultural domain. But at the end of the day, like you don't come out with it from nowhere. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. autogynephilia in that respect is a particular and very pernicious way to not just attack trans women, but also to displace the conversation from thinking about gender to thinking about sexuality as a degraded form of thinking about gender.
Sexuality and perversion.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I'm thinking that with the autogynephilia, I mean, let's just take this word and say that the autogynephilia of cis women, the alibi for that is that the sexiness is for men. So anything they do with their gender is actually about something that will be about the sex appeal for, you know, for men. So, but what a cover story, because, and also how sad, because one would hope, I mean, I hope that people could find pleasure in their gender and that that gender was not simply a good enough fit, but can be a source, again, of pleasure and flourishing and something that, you know, actually makes one feel buoyant walking around in the world, right? Why is that something that isn't possible? And this is, you know, even the limit, trying to carve sexuality out from gender, even though it's made sense sometimes in thinking about politics to, you know, to actually not conflate, let's say homosexuality and transness. If we get too sharp in that delineation, again, we lose the erotics of gender. Right, mm-hmm. Even the erotics of how gender feels to us, but the way that our gender presentation is in a form of erotic signaling so often to others.
Yeah, that's sort of the point of gender, right? That's why we adhere to strong gender roles, is to appeal sexually mm-hmm. to someone else. So yeah, it's being used against us in a lot of ways, but it's sort of in a lot of ways the point of gender.
I think that it's accurate to say that all of these theories share a common core. And the core is the invalidation of trans people. The reason that people have thought that it's wrong is because people are looking for ways to substantiate transphobia. It's wrong because autogynephilia. It's wrong because it is suppress homosexuality. It's wrong because it is about trauma. So to me, it seems that all of these theories come up as a way of trying to solidify and hook into a story and an idea that somebody starts out with, which is that there's something wrong about not being cis.
Mm-hmm. I like to talk about that a lot because that's directly my experience. I was extremely turned on by the idea and the tactile sensation of women's clothes and putting them on and things. And then as I finally developed and just started to accept myself, I got to this point where the clothes were just mine. They weren't women's clothes anymore. They were just my clothes. And this was, you know, my identity. And that's a lot of that sort of turn on, a great deal of that went away. And then I was just able to enjoy my gender, enjoy my body and myself in this gender in a completely different way. And what I've settled into it, what I feel like is a much more valid expression of it because, you know, looking in retrospect, a lot of that charge to it, a lot of that sexual tension was because of the taboo and the inability to be myself. And so it sort of just manifested in this kind of unhealthy way, honestly. It took me forever to get to the identity of trans for myself because I didn't have that experience that is the blueprint. You spend your whole life thinking you're in the wrong body. You hate your body. It's wrong, everything like that. And then, you know, that's what proves you're trans, the gender dysphoria. And while I had a general feeling through my whole life that everything was just sort of wrong, like I didn't understand life, it wasn't until I was able to get to the point of experiencing gender euphoria that being trans made sense as an identity to me.
So I love what you just said about, first of all, I hope you've trademarked gender euphoria. I love it as a counter to gender dysphoria, because you also just said something so important. If the blueprint for trans validation is gender dysphoria in childhood, so there, it's always there, it's a seed that then will grow. If you're lucky, it gets to grow into transness, the realization of it. If you're a trans person who's come into their transness differently, or actually someone who's struggling to come into transness who doesn't have that story, then you might actually feel that you're not legitimately trans. Because this is the story that is demanded of trans people to tell, certainly often to their doctors and their therapists even. You're demanded to tell that story to get the letter you need for, let's say, even access to hormones, let alone surgeries. But you may actually think you need to have that story and really mean it, as opposed to wink, wink, to get your letter, right? So that story is limiting for trans possibility.
And, you know, I was thinking also about this way that you were describing, Emily, as somebody who works with kids and has worked with trans kids and trans adolescents for many years, you speak to something that is so important to be able to take seriously in thinking about trans youth or gender nonconforming youth, that this clip, this Polaroid of you wearing kind of like touching female clothing and feeling turned on eventually develops into something else, right? Stories like, for example, about autogynephilia, take that Polaroid moment and blow it up almost as if it's the whole story of what it always was and ever will be, and miss the fact that it's just a still in a series of stills that make eventually a film. And this is one of the really complicated but important things to remember, kind of like for those of us who work with children, that anything that you see at any one moment in time is still an evolution, rather than this is it, you caught, kind of like you apprehend the quote unquote problem, and then you become panicked that that's everything there is. No, things are in movement. And those of us who work with kids see that all the time, except that it's in working with kind of like minority experience that something that we know is true for all children starts to become suspect. That's why I was saying earlier that oftentimes we look for reasons to legitimate why transphobia is rational by turning it into, by we, I mean our fields. Like I don't mean the two of us,
but looking for reasons to legitimate why transness is invalid. But here is a really beautiful story of something developing into something very, kind of like very capacious and very pleasurable and evolving.
Mm-hmm. Most people I've talked to identify, I've interviewed over 140 people at this point. Mm-hmm. I find a very, very common that people identified as early as the age of 3 as not the gender that they were born as. They don't identify with that gender. Just being straight up like, I'm not a boy, I'm a girl, you know. And it's very common. It's not again the same thing. It's not all stories, but there is so much of a common thread there with that it's important to put that as a sort of a baseline when talking mm-hmm. about trauma. I would love to dive into some of the if you have a lot of evidence yet of the types of trauma that lead to being trans, and mm-hmm. Especially in that context, saying that a large chunk happened before the age of 3. I'm kind of fascinated to know what those types of traumas are that would lead someone that young to this path that is going mm-hmm. to, you know, affect their entire life.
So I want to complicate a little bit some of the narrative that you are thinking with, kind of like when you talk about these interviews. So let's kind of like you're speaking about like people coming up and saying like, look, for me, like it started very early. I remember it very early. But I think that even that narrative is tricky. It's tricky in the following sense. Like, you know, I've worked with kids who kind of like I've started seeing when they were actually 3, and the identification with the gender that they eventually come to live into has been there all along. But especially when you live in a culture that demands a certain kind of coherence, that if you're going to say that you're trans, we're going to grant you that, but you have to have been trans from the beginning. For some people who tell the story of themselves as having always been their gender, that might be true for some people. For some people, it's also possible that they are looking back mm-hmm. on their history and they're looking for the evidence that it's there because that's the only way that they will be believed, or that's the only way in which they can make sense to themselves. So there's always this question of like, what is a retroactive reconstruction as a way of feeling more solid in one's gender, because we don't accept as easily the idea that somebody might become trans later, that somebody might become trans as an adult. Like we have a colleague who tells a story of how she started, kind of like she didn't have all of these experiences, but at 55, she started feeling a real need to transition. She doesn't say I was always trans. She says, you know, I am trans now. This is who I am now, but I haven't always been this way. Something really abrupt happened for me, and here I am. But we don't have a lot of room for those stories. So that's one thing that I would say. To your question about trauma, which is so much at the core of the book, when you ask the question of like what kind types of traumas lead to transness, and this gives us a very important opportunity to clarify something. We are not saying that any trauma leads to anything. So we are not saying, well, if you have been sexually abused, maybe, or if you have been neglected, or if you have been overstimulated by a parent who was like too angry or too invasive. We are not making those kinds of links. Why? Because it depends. Like, trauma is such a personal experience, even as we talk about it in clusters, trying to categorize it and taxonomize it. Trauma can mean all kinds of things to different people, and it can produce all kinds of different genders. It doesn't causes something, and here's where the argument that we're making in gender without identity is very tricky. We are not saying that X event causes Y gender, or that A trauma A causes kind of like B sexual identification. We're saying that different kinds of traumata that people experience, like you're forced, trauma forces you to do something with yourself about it. And through that doing, all kinds of things can arise, gender being one of them, and all kinds of genders can arise. So we are really pushing back against any kind of
kind of like having a column of traumas and a column of genders, and you just connect the lines.
Now I'm picturing the beautiful mind board with all the different strings going around. Yeah.
That's how we actually do our work. You found out our secret.
So we're really pushing back against that. But that doesn't mean that somebody might not, in the course of their treatment, think maybe that specific trauma has something to do with how my gender was shaped. Like, because we're interested in trauma being not something that only causes misery, even as misery is not to be denied. But trauma also becomes folded into the self, and it can constitute us. Mm-hmm. And it can become part of who we are, and not just in a negative way. And it is that relationship between being traumatized and doing something with your trauma, rather than doing something about your trauma, right? Because transness, in the transphobic version of like the relationship with trauma, transness is a problem because the trauma has not been treated, and it has unfortunately caused transness, right? So nothing has been done about the trauma. But if you treat it, is the story in the very in conversion therapies, if you treat the trauma, then the person can return back to what they were destined to be, which was cis. So we're not saying, obviously, we're not saying that. What we are saying is that people do things with their traumata, not in order to get rid of them, but in order to live with and through them. And that becomes part of how it becomes baked into the self. And that's kind of a very kind of like a somewhat contracted way of speaking about what we mean about the relationship between trauma and gender.
And just also, even at the most banal level, people are different from each other. So you could describe the same quote unquote traumatic event. Like we could speak of, you know, for example, sexual assault, which is all too frequent a phenomenon for feminine people, right? But not everyone experiences that. That experience doesn't mean the same thing for each person, right? So again, the same trauma has different effects because people are different from each other. There are all sorts of other variables that come into play, and in some sense, that's so banal and obvious, but it's really important because this then can also help shift the focus from the content of a particular trauma to thinking about trauma as a certain kind of energy that maybe even as trauma can cause us to be broken down, that it also can be a breaking open, a resource for transformation. And I want to say that very carefully. This is not to romanticize trauma. This is not an endorsement of trauma, but it is to say that people are not just felled by it. We're not just collapsed by it. We do things with it. And we do things with it that also in that transformation will take advantage of the materials that culture offers to us. And some of the materials that culture offers to us, I suppose this is also an answer to people who are like, oh my gosh, there's like a contagion of transness. All these kids think they're trans. Well, actually, there are more children using that language of themselves. There are more adults using that language of themselves, in part because it's more possible to have that language. There are more, and this is itself to do with history and activism, but this is now part of the cultural material that we can then use to sort of make sense of our trauma or to transform it into new shape, to transform ourselves into new shape. So again, that's to think about trauma and transness, not in this causal way, but almost in this kind of astonishing and amazing contingency of what we do with something that we might not have wanted to happen to us, trauma, taking advantage of material that we didn't put out there, but there it is, cultural material, and we can shape something that becomes ours, right? So that this agency of gender, it's a strange agency. It's not volitional, but it's still ours that we've made.
Well, it's so interesting that, as you said, it's been weaponized, you know, like the idea of a trauma, the idea of something that causes us to be this way has been weaponized. Whereas in success stories, you know, billionaires, the trauma, the things that they suffered and they overcame is what is celebrated about them.
Yes. Yes. I mean, that takes us to how there are certain things that are okay to do with trauma. Like, for example, art. Like we say, kind of like, look at this amazing piece of literature. Did you know that the author has come from a background of poverty. And that's the poignancy of the description, or when we find it in paintings or works of art, right? Or as you said, when somebody is like very professionally successful. But when we find it in gender, or when we find it in sexuality, when we find, think about kind of like feminine people who have survived sexual assault and whose sexual fantasies get inflected from that, by that violence. Like, we don't want to find trauma in sexuality. We don't want to find it in gender. But the thing is that trauma kind of like sediments in the self, and it doesn't just cause constriction, which it can, or problems. It can also bend us in different paths that we didn't necessarily expect. Mm-hmm. Trauma causes us to experiment and to invent. It's in relation to trauma that we try to invent as human beings. Not all inventions enjoy the same degree of acceptance.
I was going to ask a follow-up question to be really challenging. You say that you don't have direct, like a certain list of traumas that lead to a certain list of gender identities and sexualities. And so the follow-up question, the real challenge was, well, then how do you attribute it to traumas if you don't have that direct correlation? I feel like you've sort of answered that in the last couple answers, but is there anything else that you want to add to kind of answer that question more directly?
I think part of the difficulty of this question is that because we're psychoanalysts, we don't work with large samples. We don't do research with, like, we interviewed 100 people or we measured the depression levels of 100. We don't do that kind of research. Our research is very different because it happens one person at a time. You sit, you know, when you're working with somebody clinically, especially in psychoanalysis, you sit with them sometimes multiple times a week, oftentimes for years, and you get to know somebody really, really well. And you can then begin to make observations and links between things that they have said, early experiences that may have not been available to them from the beginning of the treatment. At the beginning, you know, it's not just trust that keeps people from talking about everything at the beginning. It's also that memory gets kindled in the course of a treatment, and new things arise in the course of a treatment. And then you begin to see a picture that gets more and more complex. And it's hard to describe this without speaking about a particular clinical case. But what we do in the book is speak in great depth about the treatment of a child that I worked with, a 12-year-old child who was assigned male at birth and who was very feminine in their presentation. And the family brought the child to treatment quite panicked about whether they were gay or whether they were trans, and really wanting me to treat that out of the child, which is a very challenging thing to be asked by a parent. And I say challenging, not because I'm ambivalent about kind of like whether I should take that mandate or not, but because the child needs to go where the child needs to go. And it is the parents sometimes that need work and help in trying to recognize that the child is not their property. And that it's in some ways, it's not just, this is true, not just about gender. It's always the parent's job to manage the distance between the child that they thought they would have and the child they have. Between the child that they imagined and they needed for themselves and the actual person who is before them. And that is true for gender, but goes far beyond it. So in the book, we try to like flesh out what this child's experiences, like familial experiences with antisemitism, what they may have to do with this child's gender, and why that is not a problem. We actually spend quite a bit of time with thinking about that. Most of the times, parents mean well and imagine that they're protecting their children, even as the protection that they try to offer can actually be quite damaging. So, you know, in this particular case, the parents came in and said to me, if our child turns out to be gay, if our child turns out to be trans, they're not going to be staying at our home. We're going to have to ask them to leave. So that actually, you know, that's when the rubber hits the road, clinically speaking, because whatever your commitments are, and my commitments are with like queer and trans flourishing, to hear a parent say, if the child is going in the direction that we all in here think they're going, we're going to kick them out of the house. The question of like, how do I do the work that this child needs to be themselves? And that means that they're going to get kicked out of the house. Like all of a sudden you start to feel, it doesn't put under question whether, I'm not saying that that's a reason to do conversion. It isn't, but it then puts you in a position of having to realize how consequential the work is. Because if the child does the work that they need to do to be themselves, then that means that terrible things can happen in a family. That's a really heavy weight to sit with as a clinician, especially when you watch it happen in real time and you watch children being constrained by parents who are trying to help them, I'll put this in quotes, and whose spirit is broken. I mean, breaking a child's spirit, in fact, it's something that I see not infrequently in my work with trans kids. It's really heartbreaking.
And there's this other phenomenon, which we talk about in Gender Without Identity. So, I mean, this is a case that Avi is just describing where the parents were not supportive. But you can have parents who are supportive, but their panic takes the following form. Please tell me, is my child gay or trans? And they want to know. So they want to know that Polaroid snap, you know, that Polaroid that Avi referred to earlier, we want to know that this is the entire life picture. And you as the therapist can't possibly know. It's also a lot to ask the child to know, right? Because this is also allowing for the becoming, like what might happen at different points in that child's life. And these are parents who really truly understand themselves to be supportive, and they think the way to be supportive is, let's just figure this out. Because if my child's gay, it means one thing. If my child's trans, I need to go talk to the teachers about something else, right? They have practical notions. Okay, this might make a difference practically, but this is also rushing the child.
It seems like their view is like, if we jump on this now, if we nip this in the bud now, we can fix it before it becomes a thing. You know, like they're young enough, like we can mold them and make them not gay, make them not trans. You know, it's our responsibility to keep the child alive and to raise them. And so it's our responsibility to make sure that they don't go down a wrong path. And again, yeah, that thing about identities as concrete silos that we get stuck into really eliminates a child's ability to explore an identity and not identify with it. Like,
yes, absolutely.
Like I would like to, I want to try this. It feels right now. I get into it. I get to a certain point. It's not right for me. There's no room for that in the current scenario.
Yeah.
And instead we get the language of detransition, right? So that someone who tries on something that actually felt like a fit for a while and then comes to decide that actually it's not a fit for me for any number of reasons. And there are complicated reasons why someone might come to that decision, including what it's like to live in a transphobic world, right? But that then shift to another position is being, you know, called detransition. We prefer to think of it as retransition, that it's another transition, right? You never go back. It's ongoing change. But the fact that someone might come to change and change again, that too is used against trans people. Basically, everything's used against trans people, no matter what story you tell about yourself, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's, you know, this idea of like, you know, this idea that even the notion of, but tell me, is my kid, you know, some kids come in and kind of like they feel pretty sturdy about who they are. They feel that they identify with this gender. And in that situation, what I encourage parents to do is to follow the child's lead. And then there's other kids who come in who don't make identity claims, who seem to be trying things out. And parents' anxiety about getting it right can sometimes, I think this is what you were speaking to, Anne, it'll be about, okay, just tell us our kid is trans, right? Because if our kid is trans, then we know how to do things. We know what pronouns, we know we need to think about kind of like blockers, we know to think, and this is very well-meaning and actually not a problem in the way that saying, if my kid is trans, I'm gonna kick them out of the house is. But it becomes a problem when the kid is still in this phase of experimenting and the parent cannot tolerate the anxiety of sitting with a child's experimentation and wants in a well-meaning way to kind of like fast forward through the experimentation, get to the outcome so that they know how to support the child. And that can create its own set of problems.
I know y'all are traveling. Does anybody have a copy of the book you can show?
This is, we were talking about this earlier. We can't believe we left home in a big hurry. So we do not actually have a copy of the book in front of us. It's, I know that you have a graphic design background, Emily. It's beautifully designed. People can go to their local bookstore and ask to order it. They can also purchase it directly from our press, the Young Conscious in Translation. Or there is this big kind of monopoly that sells a lot of books online. You can order it through for them as well. But it's beautiful. I wish I had it. Like, it's beautiful. Mm-hmm.
Perhaps we could say a little bit about the context of how it came about, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's go ahead and dive into that now. And I'm one of the main things that I wanted to ask about that and find is, you know, it's very clearly, because the word is on a different, is going vertically, without is very important. Gender,
yes.
Without identity. And so my main question around that is, why is it important for you to look at those very separately?
I think for some of the reasons that we've already been exploring, kind of like because of this Polaroid metaphor that we've been using and the way that identity actually makes the Polaroid into the entire story. So we are not trying to say that people don't have a gender experience that is valid in the moment, that is worth the dignity of belief just on the basis of how somebody experiences it to be. That it doesn't have to be an identity that is unchanging, because identity comes with certain implications, right? That it has to do with something that is true about you, right? True means, what is a true gender? Like, we have told as a culture ourselves the story that that cisness is a true gender. That's why we put cisness under so much pressure in gender without identity. But identity requires something that is innate and authentic when all gender is experimentation. It requires stability, which gets us into the problem that Anne was talking about earlier with detransitioners who are, in fact, moving through different forms of their gender. If you have a gender identity, you could get it right and you could get it wrong. And what we're saying is that there's nothing right or wrong about gender. Gender just exists on the basis of how it is experienced at any one moment. And that could be more stable for some people and less stable for others.
Even as we're trying again to maybe bring out into the open, the more complex, the more messy stories so many queer people and trans people are already telling about ourselves, right? We're not legislating how any one queer person or trans person should tell the story of their gender or their sexuality. We're not saying stop using the term identity, right? Mm-hmm. We are trying to maybe put identity in quotes. We're trying to loosen some of the stranglehold it has on our political imagination. Mm-hmm. We want to try to open up space to have different kinds of conversations at a time when, you know, trans people and queer people are under attack, and trans people especially, with, 500 bills introduced into state legislatures this year alone. The higher burden is on trans people and trans kids especially, right? So at this moment, for anyone to stand up and sort of claim the identity as trans is actually to be like commended and validated. So again, we're not legislating what the terms anyone uses, but we want to make room in public for all the terms and all the stories we're already telling. But we think we just have to, for the sake of just getting people not to try to eradicate us, we have to sort of say we're all born this way, whether queer or trans. Mm-hmm. Like, and wink, wink, wink. We don't all mean it. Some of us do, right? But what if, first, that's not working, but I think politically, ethically, it's short-sighted, because the reason not to discriminate against queer and trans people is because queer and trans people deserve the same kinds of, dignity and sort of set of opportunities as anyone else, right? It's not being born that way shouldn't be the reason why we don't discriminate against someone. That makes no sense, ethically. And also, we just have different, we have more stories than we've been allowed to tell.
One of the things that one of the theories that I've put together that comes from, very, very strongly in being trans, but also being a queer identified person, especially a little bit younger and having parents, parents that will kick you out, that won't accept all of that, you know, I grew up with this belief in unconditional love, and being trans has really kind of shot that in the butt and mm-hmm. and in a way proven to me that there is no such thing as unconditional love. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if that would be a good topic to kind of dive into for a second and get your opinions on that.
Oh, this is like such a painful topic to think about, because so many trans adults and trans children have exactly the experience that you're talking about, Emily. And, you know, one of our emphasis in the book, we are addressing clinicians and we say, we don't want you to be interested in the philanthropy of inclusivity. Like, we don't care. We it's not enough to be talking about just accepting queer and trans kids. Like, we are working towards therapeutic cultures that actively want trans children, that appreciate the sturdiness that they come with, because just like you were saying earlier in the conversation, Emily, kind of like you were talking about how much effort it takes, how much one has to overcome in oneself to be able to identify oneself as trans, how many times they have to push back against parts of themselves that tell them, maybe it's not that. Are you sure? Maybe it's another thing. Maybe it doesn't have to be this way. Maybe you can live without it. Maybe just on weekends. Maybe just with friends. Maybe just this. Like, all of these maybes that one has to push back against before they can say, start to even dare to themselves that they may be trans. And that's, you know, sometimes I was sitting with a colleague the other day who knows about my work with trans children. He said to me, what do you say to a parent who says to you, I have a kid who just came out as trans? And I said, the first thing that I say to you is that to them is, there's something going on with your kid that is so sturdy that they can say to you, that they can come to you and say, I am not who you think I am. Not all kids have the resource to do that. And that is an incredible. So when you talk about unconditional love, like, I'm thinking of like what it means to be not just accepted, but wanted. To be wanted in this world, to be wanted in this field, to be wanted in our communities, queer communities, but also cis and straight communities.
Well, you know, I'm also, I found that question amazing, Emily. And thinking about, you know, part of what I think, what is the scandal of trans children? I mean, there's so much focus on trans children. We know that people trying to pass bills that would ban young people's access to gender affirmative care also want to ban it for adults. They think children are the way in. That said, I think the focus on children is also about something else. Trans children do something that children aren't allowed to do. They actually tell adults something about themselves that actually contradicts the way adults see them. So they challenge the property-based relationship between parents and children. Children are the property of their parents. Parental rights give those parents rights over those children. This is an argument that Jules Gill-Peterson, who's the author of this beautiful book and a very important book, Histories of the Transgender Child, has made. But the trans child who has the sturdiness, the audacity to say to the parent, well, actually, I'm a girl. Like, wow. I mean, this is a claim for autonomy against an adult world. And I think that's part of what people find so panicky about trans children, because what if more children were like that, had the audacity to tell adults something that adults don't want to hear, right? And to sort of like, basically, like, you say you love me unconditionally? Well, let's put a check on that. Let's find out.
Well, look at the political movement right now. It's very focused on control, having control of all these different things so that they don't get out of hand, or because of this fear of you know, this wave or something happening, women's rights getting erased, women's safe spaces getting erased, those sorts of things. There's this just general feeling of like needing to control everything, otherwise it'll get out of hand. And it's very interesting that is sort of a key tenet of the parent-child relationship to begin with.
It is authoritarianism at the familial level, right? And often an authoritarianism which understands itself and even feels itself to be loving kind, supportive, but
and protective,
conditional, and protective.
Mm-hmm.
I did note down property-based relationship. I don't know what I'm gonna do with that. I love that. That is so interesting and so colorful a topic, so colorful of a phrase to think about when you're talking about parents and the way parent-child relationships are challenging.
Yeah.
I guess it's just mainly challenging when you're trying to be yourself and exert your own identity outside of their expectations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was going to say that developmentally speaking, children, ideally need in their early life a certain sense of going on being, is a phrase that a psychoanalyst called Winnicott has given us. Kind of like the idea that one can be held and continue to live and develop and flourish without impingement, without intrusion, without kind of like a control is the way that you were using earlier, Emily. And if you don't get that early on, and very few people do, by the way, this kind of like very few people have experiences of parents who do not impinge in certain ways. And then some people have more impingement than others on the basis of their, for example, their gender or the parents' pathology or the parents' trauma. If you don't get this very early on, and you also happen to live in a world that does not make a home for you, as a cis world does not make a home for trans people, then kind of like then the question of like where can you not just be safe, but where can you love, where can you be loved, begins to feel very precarious, and it begins to feel very dangerous. And then trans people are also punished for that, for their feelings of unsafety, for their feelings of, I was speaking to a colleague a few years ago, we were having a conversation, a pretty heated conversation, adversarial conversation about transness, and he's actually, the analyst, the psychoanalyst who was very active in making sure that the gender identity clinic in London was closed down. So somebody who did a lot of anti-trans clinical activism. And we were going back and forth. We were actually talking about suicidality. And he said to me what I think is one of the most preposterous things that I have heard in my life as a clinician and as a human being. We were talking about trans existence and depression and suicidality. And he said to me, but not all of those kids kill themselves, which is a preposterous thing to say. Preposterous, kind of like it speaks to the not just unwelcoming space that psychoanalysis makes for trans subjects, but also the hate, the sheer hate in that phrase. And I asked him, I said to him, you're saying this as if to live with suicidality for those who don't kill themselves is a win. To live being suicidal but not killing yourself is not a big problem because somebody has not killed themselves. I mean, the level of hatred that trans people live with in this world is really astonishing. It is incredible, kind of like the sturdiness of trans people to be able to survive in an environment that doesn't want them and to be able to live and create and love and create kind of like the campy cultures that can come from some trans communities. It would be something to be kind of like celebrating and to be excited for. And this is very much at the heart of our book. Like we wrote this book because kind of like we see this sturdiness and we see how much adversity trans people are facing, especially in our field. This is also something that we can talk more about. I'd actually like to speak a little bit more about that. And we want to speak not just to other therapists, but also to younger clinicians who are afraid, but for very good reasons, and to say that there's reason to fight for clinical spaces that can work in this way.
I mean, I suppose we have our own fist in the air in this book in terms of trying to sort of like, in some sense, punch down the walls in psychoanalysis. And you know, psychoanalysis has blood in its hands in the way that it has historically treated, you know, sort of queer people, sexually queer people, and certainly trans people. And we, you know, we have an ambivalent love relation to psychoanalysis. It is certainly not unconditional love. It's done great damage. It continues to do great damage, sadly, as the clinic anti-trans clinical activism of this particular clinician Avi was just mentioning testifies. But we do think that psychoanalysis and other kinds of therapy, we're, you know, psychoanalysts, but we think it has a lot to offer as well.
Yeah.
But it only has something to offer if psychoanalysis can look outside itself and actually learn from, for example, queer of color and trans of color critique. I mean, we extensively draw on work from outside psychoanalysis to be able to think about the complexity of gender and sexuality in this book. We couldn't have done the thinking in our book without trans studies, without queer studies, without the, you know, the particular kind of feminist work we're using. So we think psychoanalysis basically needs to be shaken up in order to maybe fulfill its promise to actually allow for, you know, actually to talk about complexity. It can talk about complexity beautifully, but it needs to be able to talk about complexity for trans people and queer people, not just for cis people.
Yeah. I mean, it's because of psychoanalysis that we can flesh out the argument of why the notion of a core gender identity makes no sense, not for cis people or trans people. It's because of psychoanalysis that we can make the argument about trauma. And also, and this is the thing that I wanted to come back to earlier, if you're sitting here thinking, well, who cares about psychoanalysis? This is one reason to care. Right now, some of the most powerful anti-trans movements are led by psychoanalysts. The concept of rapid onset gender dysphoria was architected with the help of psychoanalyst Lisa Marciano. SEGEM, the Society for Evidence-Based Gender Medicine, which provides a citational footprint for some of the anti-trans laws in Texas and Alabama that are, and other laws that are being drafted across the country. The president of that organization is a psychoanalyst. The Tavistock Clinic in London was closed down because of the anti-trans activism of a psychoanalyst. Like, we need to be interested in psychoanalysis for what it can give us and for the dangers that it brings.
Well, that's a fascinating way to look at your own field and just say that, like, it can be really helpful, but to have to fight back against the danger in that. And that previous story of that colleague, it's just such a poignant thing to bring up, where I think that's a very common thing across our society, that if you haven't killed haven't committed suicide, that's a win. Living with suicidality, that's fine. You know, that's okay. As long as you haven't done the act, then everything is peachy. And, you know, living in that is the worst. I've been down that deep, dark hole three different times in my life. And, you know, it's bad. And it's very sad to see that some of the people that are charged with helping us in that and helping us out of that, you know, just kind of see that as being a good place, because you haven't taken the steps.
Yeah. I mean, there's something murderous about that, right? Like the idea that a valid trans person is a person who has been so unhappy that they kill themselves, because those numbers count, right? Mm-hmm. But the numbers of trans people who survive, those don't tell as powerful of a story. And it reminds me of how, like, actually it reminds me of something that I've been thinking about a lot lately thinking about sex workers' rights, you know, like that sex workers kind of like who are sexually assaulted, kind of like are not seen as possible to rape. They're not rapeable because they are sex workers, right? That's always the stereotype. And unless they have been willing to murder or physically hurt their rapist, unless they have been willing, in other words, to risk their lives, they are not taken seriously as victims of sexual assault. And the parallel that I'm drawing here is that there are certain subjects, in this case, sex workers and trans people, for whom, unless you are encountering a very high level of violence, their pain, their suffering will not be taken seriously until it reaches levels that are really extreme. And that's the That's the bar that we expect people to clear. And that bar is unacceptable. Mm-hmm. And that's why we feel so passionate about critiquing our field, even as we're using it, and why we want to encourage other clinicians to refuse that blackmail and not kind of like not take psychoanalysis at its words and do the wondrous things that one can do with it, as we try to do in this book.
Well, it seems pretty ironic that that is sort of a struggle there, because it seems like psychoanalysis, the point to it is to dive deep and find the nuance.
Yes,
and yet the absolutely. Things that are accepted are, again, the extremes. And you know, you bring up an interesting point about just sort of society in general looking at trans people. The two truly valid identities as a trans person are either the people that commit suicide because they can't deal with it and they can't be themselves, yes. or the people that, you know, get all the surgeries, blend in perfectly, look, you know, like for trans women, look completely feminine and just pass.
Yeah.
And then, you know, same thing for trans men. And those are the two valid ways of being trans, and everything else in the middle, which is where most of us are, is not trans yeah. enough. Is not, you're not mm-hmm. quite yeah. doing enough. You're not doing the work.
Yeah. But you know, the two examples that, I mean, that's so interesting where you just sort of like snapped that, Emily, because the example of the trans person who's so trans that she killed herself, that's when we know she was truly trans, or the trans person who's so trans, so trans-binary that they disappear into the gender that they crossed into. In either case, there are no trans people left. There's either the yes. dead trans person mm-hmm. or the trans person who's passed into cisness. So we never have to encounter anyone who's actually trans or trans-identifiable. Because this
there's
is
no trans
fantasy.
People in public. Yeah.
Yeah. The fantasy is, right, and this is a genocidal fantasy. I'm here thinking again with Jules Kiel-Peterson mm-hmm. or Eve Kostofsky Sedgwick, is for a world with as few trans people as possible. Right. This is Thanks. Also why let's not allow for young people to have access to puberty blockers, right? Because, okay, we'll stop discriminating against trans adults because the Supreme Court told us we had to. Like in terms of employment discrimination, we're not allowed to do it anymore. Damn that Supreme Court. Actually, I say damn that Supreme Court about a lot of things, right? But there's a furor about that decision. So what do you do about that? Well, let's just make sure there are as few trans adults as possible. Another way to do that is let's not let kids grow up to be trans.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Transgender Show from the Transverse Network. Watch this show live Tuesday nights at twitch.tv/thetransverse and later on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/thetransverse. Pick up your copy of Anne and Avi's book, Gender Without Identity, wherever books are sold. If you love what we're doing and want to help support the Transverse and get access to exclusive content, you can do so by visiting patreon.com/thetransverse.